Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are here to answer the question, your fridge knows what you ate last night, but what happens if it's subpoenaed? Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. I would be highly embarrassed by my refrigerator being subpoenaed. So let's hope that never happens. So you might have guessed by that intro that today we are talking about the Internet of Things. And this actually was a listener request. So shout out to Zach. He wanted to hear more about our Internet of Things. We did a little flock talk on that previously. So we're going to expand upon that today. But before we get started, Angie, what's going on? I mean, school's back in session. Summer is technically supposed to be over, but it's not.
Y'all start super early down there. Yes. I'm like, I've got 2 weeks before school starts.
Dude, you know what's really messed up is that it's so freaking hot in Texas that my son, school, because he's in middle school, they have rules about the heat index and like how hot it can be or not be when the kids are allowed to practice outside.
Oh my God.
So in order to meet the heat index requirements, they have to arrive at school at 5:15 a.m. on the daily.
Oh my God.
We're waking up at 4:30. I literally feel like I'm in college right now. I feel like I missed a party. Must have drank a lot because I don't even remember the party. But I have been exhausted this week.
I hate that. When you're so tired, you feel hungover and you're like, okay, but I didn't get to have the fun part got me here.
You know, it's my son is so excited about it, which I'm now like wondering if he's even my child. Like I was not ever excited about going to school, certainly not to play sports. And I would definitely not be wanting to wake up at 4:30 in the morning to do pretty much anything. So, you know, hats off to him. This has been a major adjustment in my household.
Oh my God. And like, how long do you have to do this for?
All of football season, man. So that goes until basically like November-ish.
I'm sorry, I can't unfreeze my face from the horrified expression I have right now. Oh, that's unpalatable.
I mean, he better remember this when I'm old and I can't take care of myself. And he better get his butt over to grandma's house and take care of me because this is out of the normal that we should be doing for our children.
Oh my God.
That's what I've been up to. What about you guys?
I got hit by a bus.
Wait, what? What are you talking about? You have this way of dropping bombs and it's like, oh, guess what? I got hit by a bus. Wait, you never told me about this.
I know. I love to just like slip a bomb drop in.
Yeah, you do.
And be like, okay, but it's actually not that dramatic. Okay, so I was coming home. I'm driving my mother-in-law's car home and I'm stopped. It's like two lanes and both lanes can take a right. And so I'm in the one that's for the closest to the curb. And then there's a big tour bus just to my left. All the cars in front of me take their rights without any issue. I go to take mine and I realize, oh my God, this tour bus is going to come into my lane and they're going to hit my mother-in-law's car. And so I slam on the brakes and I am fully stopped, have not made my turn yet. And the tour bus hits me.
Oh my gosh.
I was sort of like struck dumb. I was like, okay, what do we do about this?
This is your second rear end car accident of the year. So yes. Let's not forget.
I know, I'm really on a bad streak. Anyways, so the bus doesn't stop. So I like call John and I'm like, this just happened to me. Like, what am I supposed to do? I'm following this bus now because I haven't stopped and I need to get their license plate number.
It was a good run.
And also like I need to talk to her. Like maybe she didn't notice she hit me, whatever. So I pull up next to the bus. And I'm like, wave at this woman. And she kind of rolls down her little window. And I'm like, hi, you hit me back there. And she goes, well, yeah, you didn't get out of my way.
God.
And I was like, what? I was stopped in my lane. You came into my lane and hit me. And she goes, yeah, ma'am, I have a big bus.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, but you hit me. And she goes, well, I almost hit a fire hydrant because of you. I was like, I was stopped. That is not my problem.
Yeah, you should have hit that fire hydrant.
She's like, ma'am, you should know that big buses make turns like that. That's actually not how this works at all. It is your job to stay in your lane and not hit people. Mm-hmm. I'm going about my business in my lane. You crossed the lane line and hit me. And she's like, okay, that's nice, ma'am. Have a nice day. Rolls her window up and drives away. So then I keep chasing her because I'm like, well, I'll figure out
what she's going. If this was in Texas, there would already be guns out somewhere.
Oh, I know, I know. She's eating this. I filed a police report later because it was a hit and run, in fact. She was eating like a really big bag of green grapes. And so I included that in the police report. I was like, middle-aged woman wearing glasses eating bagged green grapes. So that's now in the record for posterity's sake. Anyways.
Did you have damage to your car? I mean, was it?
No, okay. I don't think so. I mean, there's possibly like something latent or whatever, but luckily it seemed okay. But yeah, I like come home just livid, right?
Oh,
just
my gosh.
Livid. Then the next morning I woke up and I had COVID. And I was like, well, okay. So here's rock bottom. I found it.
Your luck just can't get any better, can it?
I had all these fun plans. I was going to go get very fancy martinis with my friends. No.
Robbed. Oh, man.
Robbed.
Well,
but
maybe
you know what I should do? Spend a lot of money on the internet laying in bed.
Oh, God. That's dangerous.
Well, Bree, before we dive into today's episode, we have some very special guests, Allison Dowd and Jennifer Salvadori, and they are from the Techno Security Conference. There is an East iteration of it and a West iteration. Bree and I have spoken at Techno Security West as the eDiscovery Chicks before, and we invited Allison and Jennifer on the pod today to promo their conferences because we think the material that they put on is something that all of our listeners could benefit from hearing more about. So Allison and Jennifer, welcome to the pod and thanks for stopping by to share with our listeners some information about these fantastic conferences that you put on.
Hi,
thanks for having us, Angie.
So can you maybe start by telling our listeners what are your conferences about? And if folks attend, what can they expect to learn?
TechnoWest is a three-day conference that is jam-packed with educational learning. It covers four different tracks, including digital forensics, investigation, cybersecurity, and e-discovery. We're excited to add e-discovery into the conference about 3 years ago, and it's been growing. We had speakers like Bree and Angie, like we mentioned, covering topics about new tools and technology, some topics that I'm sure are going to be on the ready at TechnoWest.
So I know that TechnoWest has kind of changed location. When Angie and I first spoke, and I spoke the year before that too, it was in Pasadena, California. And so this year is a little bit different. It's going to be in San Diego. So can you guys share with us, you know, number one, how exciting that is and what the venue is going to be like, and also the date of TechnoWest?
Absolutely. You're correct. We were in Pasadena the last 2 years. The conference in West started out in 2019, actually, and we were at the Hilton La Jolla at Torrey Pines, so essentially San Diego, growing incredibly. We got through COVID on that one, and it was growing so quickly, the previous management decided to move it to Pasadena, wanted to get a little bit closer to the LA scene. After looking at some of our surveys and everything, it made sense. We moved it to the Pasadena Convention Center and essentially tried to get too big too quick. So I am excited to announce that we are going back to San Diego this year. My opinion, we should have never left. didn't have a lot of say in it the last couple of years, but our new management has given Allison and I the reins on that one. And we will be at the Town and Country Resort, October 27th through the 29th. We looked at a lot of different properties and we selected this one actually because it's kind of a throwback property. It reminds me a lot of the Marriott where the event on the East originated. So it's got everything under one roof, all your hotel rooms, all the conference sessions. It's got a cool hangout area in at nighttime, which is just something we really enjoyed. You know, the hanging out in the bar, the cigars out on the patio. Don't know that we can do that in California anymore with the cigars on the patio like Myrtle Beach, but it really has that cool vibe.
I know that you guys have incorporated eDiscovery as a part of the Techno Security Conference programming in the last few years. I'm curious why you made that decision.
Well, there's a lot of overlap, right? There's a lot of overlap in what eDiscovery professionals and forensic investigators use as far as technologies, especially with district attorney's offices nowadays adding investigators more and more as more digital evidence comes into play. It just made sense, you know, from a case to closure, it just is part of that continuum. It's not a really big part of the conference yet, but as Allison said, it is growing. We do anticipate that to keep growing as we serve some of the industry supporters that are aligned with us. The Association of Certified eDiscovery Specialists have jumped on board to help us get the word out about the conference, as have Women in eDiscovery. So just keep an eye on it. I think it's going to grow even quicker in the coming years.
It did kind of happen organically too. Like, we would have more judges speak at our conference, not in a dedicated eDiscovery track, and maybe panels with people working in eDiscovery or prosecutors or, you know, district attorney's office. So they were there. It just wasn't a dedicated track like it is now. And I think it really just kind of started forming itself. And Jen and I were looking, doing our post-show analysis and seeing what's happening there. And we're like, this is something that we could expand on and offer. That definitely played a part in it as well.
Well, and can I say, I feel like you all are being influencers in that way. I feel like the industry in general is just starting to wake up to this intersectionality between things like forensics and e-discovery and sort of traditional litigation and InfoGov. And so the fact that you're putting it all in one place, I feel like just puts you on the cutting edge.
I really do feel like you guys have been trailblazers, and you probably don't even realize that you are.
No. But
definitely not.
But I do feel like you are, not only for including eDiscovery, but also for embracing women in the industry. So I appreciate both of those aspects of your support. And I know that I always feel so honored to be a part of Technosecurity, because a lot of the people that go to those conferences are law enforcement and people that are also supporting law enforcement and trying to actually prevent crime, prevent issues that happen with children, men and women, and a lot of very sensitive subject matter. And so I have a lot of respect and admiration for the folks that do come to these conferences. It's very different than a typical eDiscovery conference. eDiscovery conferences tend to be a little bit more corporate and buttoned up. Technosecurity is a lot of fun. It's more casual. A lot of that is because of the folks that are there. It's once you've kind of been through war, you don't feel like putting a suit on. It's nice to be able to like kick back, smoke a cigar, or have a cocktail and catch up with folks. And I enjoy that atmosphere you guys both kind of foster for not only the attendees, but also the speakers at the conference. So I've been very grateful for that and enjoyed that throughout the years. Well, Allison and Jennifer, thank you so much for being here today and sharing with us about the Technosecurity West and your conferences in general. If our listeners are interested in finding out more information, how would they do that?
Very simple. Follow us on LinkedIn, Technosecurity and Digital Forensics Conference, the most up-to-date current announcements, attendee discounts, content information will be posted there. And of course, on our website, technosecurity.us. And if you need to reach out to Allison and I with any specific questions, our contact information is on the website. We are very accessible. We love to hear from our exhibitors, our attendees, our speakers. So anything, just literally call us on our cell phones.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for being here. We appreciate it. I'm looking forward to seeing you both, and I hope that a lot of our flock will join.
Anyway, we could talk all day.
Oh, yeah.
But we do have to talk about the Internet of Things, or IoT. Capital I, little O, capital T.
I always like misread it as idiot for some reason. I'm like, it
oh my God, that's amazing.
Like
that.
All right.
Awesome.
So let's define the Internet of Things, or IoT. The network of physical objects or things that are embedded with sensors and software to connect and exchange data with other devices or systems via the internet. We're talking about this subject today, not just because, you know, we're grateful for Zach for recommending it, but we also want to explore how the Internet of Things has transformed eDiscovery. What's possible now, what's problematic, and what legal professionals must do to handle it in a defensible way.
Oh, yes. And this matters, y'all. This is of the moment, hot off the press, because first of all, IoT evidence, it's no longer rare. It's everywhere. It's increasingly present in litigation, in criminal investigations, and in regulatory actions. So you gotta know how to handle it. Second reason why this matters is that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, especially Rules 26 and 37 for the nerds listening, well, they apply. And so the obligations in those rules apply to the Internet of Things, which means that failing to identify and preserve can mean losing critical evidence and or facing sanctions, which nobody wants. And finally, the number of IoT devices is projected to more than double by 2030. So this is no longer emerging tech. It's a mainstream.
All right. So let's set the table, as I like to say. I gave you like the school book definition earlier, but let's really dive into what this means. The Internet of Things is interconnected devices generating ESI, or electronically stored information. And they have the ability to collect and exchange data automatically without human initiations. Dun, dun, dun.
Bum, 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 the robot.
So we have three different categories. One would be consumer. So these are things like your refrigerator that Angie was talking about earlier, or we're using them in our homes for entertainment or convenience and personal monitoring, like somebody on this podcast that's always talking about her Oura Ring, Google Home and Nest, Amazon Echo, which, oh my Lord, if our Google Home could tell some stories.
Alexa, what's my alibi?
Right. Vacuum robots and smart refrigerators, et cetera, et cetera. So you get that. So that's consumer. Another category of the Internet of Things is commercial. These are data sources that are used by businesses and service industries like retail, healthcare, and office environments, such as smart conference rooms. Have you ever been in one of those smart conference rooms?
Yes,
like they are fancy.
It is so, like, freaky.
The fogged up glass that happens when you enter into the room is so cool. Anyway, smart HVAC systems, smart lighting systems, security cameras, smart point of sale terminals, inventory monitoring sensors, etc. So the third class of the Internet of Things that we'll discuss is industrial. These are sensors that are used within different industries like manufacturing, energy, transportation. And there would be something like predicting maintenance, or industrial robots, or drones for inspection, or fleet management telematics. So those are some examples of the three different categories of the Internet of Things. I hope I'm painting the picture that this is a very big scope of data sources that could potentially have relevant data. All right, so now that you know the three categories of the Internet of Things, let's talk about why they are unique. Well, they're passive, constant data capture that's being captured without user initiation. So you don't know when your Google Home might be listening to you and talking about, I don't know, what are the embarrassing things we talk about at our house? Like,
oh my God,
who ate the last drumstick? Yeah, the fact that we're not initiating the data that's being stored on them makes them unique. Most traditional ESI, like emails or chat logs, is intentional. A human decides to send it. The Internet of Things is different. A device is recording on its own, whether or not the user is aware. So the examples include some of the things we're just talking about, like a smart thermostat logging temperature changes every 5 minutes, or a vehicle GPS pinging location every 30 seconds. And this matters because this passive nature of the Internet of Things makes the evidence more objective and less subject to claims of human manipulation. But it also means that the data volume is massive and often underappreciated during scoping.
Yes. And the other, you know, a second reason why this evidence has such a unique profile is that it is highly granular and it often produces second-by-second logs. Many IoT devices generate very high-frequency records. Some of them are every second, some hundreds of times a second in industrial contexts, you know, kind of everything in between. So this can capture micro-events. A door sensor registering an open close within milliseconds, or a fitness tracker detecting a sudden heart rate change. And this matters because that level of granularity can pinpoint precise timelines in a way that human recollection or slower logging sources, like CCTV, just can't. It also means you might need specialized tools to parse through and align this level of detail.
The Internet of Things provides environmental context that confirms or contradicts human accounts. The Internet of Things doesn't just log what and when, it often logs conditions like temperature, humidity, light level, acceleration, noise. An example might be a smart home motion sensor that logs both the time of the movement and the ambient light level, showing someone entered a dark room at night, or your cat or your dog entered your room at night. It matters because context data can corroborate or undermine witness statements. For example, they could show that a person couldn't have been where they claimed or that an event happened under different conditions than they actually described.
Ooh.
Dun, all right. Dun, dun.
Let's get nerdy for a sec. Let's talk about the legal. Under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 26B1, the nerds' ears are all poking up right now, mine included. So that rule speaks to proportionality. And now just because IoT data exists does not mean it's always discoverable. But on the flip side, failing to look for it isn't defensible. What do I mean by that? You gotta look for it. You might not have to produce it if it's too burdensome for whatever reason. Second federal rule we got to pause on here is the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37E, which deals with spoliation. And we talk about that here because once there's a duty to preserve, the loss of relevant IoT data could land you in hot water, could land you with some sanctions. So for example, say there's a workplace injury case and the employer doesn't preserve relevant safety sensor logs. They could face evidentiary sanctions, even if that data would have been, you know, massively burdensome to produce or is really hard to get at or whatever. The data still exists. You have a duty to preserve it.
So the practical entry point, when does the Internet of Things actually collide with e-discovery? Well, it's at the very beginning. So if we're talking about the EDRM, this is part of the identification step. What are all the data sources that I need to consider to be placed on legal hold, or I might need to collect data from them? Because perhaps it's responsive data in this lawsuit or to answer a subpoena or the investigation that I'm working on. A lot of people start with custodian interviews. This is asking the employee that you think may be involved with this matter. Things like, do you have a company issued wearable? Or was there a smart home device in the location in question? Or does your fleet have telematics or dash cams? Those are things that you would ask your employees, but it's really important here to consider other people. I mean, we're always talking about collaboration. This is a great time to talk to your internal IT folks. Hey guys, do you know anything about the office over there? Are there any smart devices? Are there cameras? What needs to be considered? Are there the little badge swipe things? Do those matter? Because I need to know when somebody came and left. Or you may even need to inquire with a forensic expert at this point. You know, hey guys, I have this matter. It deals with whatever. It deals with the Angie gets run over by a bus situation. So what are some things that I need to consider? And a forensic specialist might be able to tell you things like, well, those kinds of buses always have these kinds of systems, and this is how we get the data from them. And did you consider that the red lights may also have some cameras on them? Or there might have been other folks around you that have their dash cams going on. Let's investigate that. And you may even, and I have actually had to do this before, I've had to hire a private investigator to basically spy on the person that I'm investigating to figure out what else I might want to consider that.
And there.
Yeah. Anyway, it can go on and I won't, but it matters because if you don't ask about it in the beginning, you might not ever know that they exist until it's too late, meaning like opposing counsel might figure out that they exist and wonder why you did not preserve your data or produce it. And you could be looking at some spoliation charges and fines.
Exactly. Or like, what I was thinking is somebody says there's, you know, some sort of after hours office robbery and all the cameras are turned off and they're trying to figure out it's like a whodunit. And the only evidence they have is that a tea kettle was turned on, you know, at a specific time, a smart tea kettle. And there's only one person's fingerprints on it. Well, that's evidence. And you can kind of put that person in the building at a specific time based on when the tea kettle turned on.
Wow. Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, let's talk about the Sedona conference. So this next section is going to be a primer on the Sedona conference's best practices in IoT e-discovery. Now, first off, why are we talking about this? Well, we're talking about it because the Sedona conference is one of the preeminent working groups that discusses best practices for e-discovery. And in July of 2025, they released a primer on IoT ESI, and it is now probably the most authoritative playbook for handling that evidence defensively. The primer covers the entire e-discovery lifecycle, from identifying relevant devices to authenticating that data in court. And it matters because courts are increasingly expecting lawyers who already know this guidance. It is no longer a nice to have, nor is it separating the wheat from the chaff. So let's hit on some key guidance from the Sedona Conference's primer. The first thing that they touch on is early identification. And they recommend that you bring IoT into scoping discussions and ESI protocols from the outset. For example, if a dispute involves vehicle use, immediately consider fleet telematics or dash cam systems if they exist. Ask what other systems might come into play here, because IoT data can vanish quite quickly due to limited storage. Like we've touched on a couple of times, it's often voluminous. It is often, you know, regenerating on a regular cadence, and it can vanish if there isn't enough storage to hold all of it. So if you don't know it exists early, you might never recover it.
So that is where preservation comes into play, like we were talking about earlier, the very beginning of the EDRM. What are some tips here? I'd say be proactive and know what you have before you get the request or the investigation. This is a perfect little chat that you could have with your IT folks and say, hey, guys, what are our smart devices that we have here? Or, you know, if you're a large company, what are smart devices in certain subsidiaries or whatever? What do I need to consider? So you can start making a checklist. When you have to consider IoT, you'll already have your checklist ready to go and it will be a no-brainer. You could also draft targeted hold notices with instructions specific to the device type and storage method. Sometimes when folks are getting that legal hold notice, that is a great vehicle for us to kind of jog their memory and ask some questions about the devices that may be involved. And move fast. And that is really important because some devices overwrite data in as little as 24 hours. I mean, I can't imagine that your Oura Ring, I don't know how long it saves data, but probably not that much long.
I don't know. All I know is it's judging me all the time.
But yeah, act fast. That's important. It matters because you don't want to receive those sanctions whenever you didn't preserve the data. It's no longer there. And we lose court credibility with the court.
It also might be data that's good for you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we don't have to look on the dark side like I always do.
I mean, we could.
After we've identified it, we've preserved it, now we need to think about collecting it. So some tips for that might be things like direct extractions from the device. So don't spend your time trying to go find connectors and API connectors and those kinds of things for these devices. That's not going to work. You're going to have to extract it from the device, and it's going to require that you have the right hardware or software, and you have the right people who know how to do this, which could be people outside of your organization that specialize in whatever those devices are. And that's another thing that you could be proactive about once you figure out what my IoT items are that I need to be worried about in the first place, then go to the next step of, well, who could extract data from them? And then we have some cloud provider situations that we might need to consider, like my CPAP machine, because I'm old and I snore.
Hey.
There's cloud data there that it saves so that me and my doctor and the nurses can all access the data in the same place. So that would mean that I'd have to, or somebody would have to, extract that data from a cloud location to see what was Bree doing in the middle of the night. Was she sleeping like she was supposed to or not? And they will usually need things like legal processes. Like you might have to go get a subpoena. We were talking about that much earlier in our episodes when it came to mobile data. You have to get a subpoena sometimes to get information from the phone companies. Same with IoT. And it also might need some sort of legal process that you'll have to take to court and argue back and forth with the opposing party to see if you even have the right to sanction my CPAP data. As many devices as we have in the Internet of Things, there are methods to extract the data from them. So you want to wrap your mind around this in a proactive way. And we want to make sure that the way we're extracting data is complete, and we can prove up the authenticity or the defensibility behind how we did that collection.
So Federal Rule of Evidence 902 speaks to authentication, and a couple subparts of that rule allow for self-authentication of machine-generated data when it's supported by a certification from a qualified person. This is ideal for IoT logs, since much of it is created automatically by the device without human input. Rule 902 also covers data copied from electronic files, storage media, or files if a qualified person certifies that the copy is accurate. This often applies when pulling IoT data from a cloud account or when imaging a device. Now, a tip here is to always maintain hash values and document collection steps to prove the defensibility of your process. And that will go a long way in furthering your authenticity argument. This whole thing is really kind of coming to a head in the context of IoT right now because courts are so much more willing to admit IoT data when the authentication path is both clear and well documented. And it also can help preempt common defense challenges about data tampering or alteration or something being a fake. And all of that will give the court confidence in the reliability of the IoT evidence you are seeking to proffer.
So now I get to talk about one of my favorite things. Following along with the theme of authentication, we need to make sure when we're collecting devices or data that we have a chain of custody. So we want to define a chain of custody process. That's something you want to do beforehand, trust me, because you don't want to be scrambling at the last minute trying to figure out, well, what do we need to get IT to sign or HR to sign or whatever. That's a good thing to be proactive on. It's also kind of along the lines of cross-collaboration, like I was talking earlier, a good subject for you to discuss with your IT folks. And also, you want to think as an e-discovery professional, you want to think about what you would require from an outside vendor as well. So perhaps you already have a form or process that's been defined that you can easily loop somebody into. Proportionality is something to consider when we are gathering data from all these funky data sources. And okay, I'm going to have to talk about the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which I usually leave to Angie.
Yay! But
FRCP 26B1 means that proportionality means you must weigh costs against the likely value of the evidence. The reason it matters is because you want to be able to argue when the opposing party says something ridiculous, like the lady eating grapes on the bus is like, I do not believe you, girl. And so I'm going to ask you to prove it with dash cams of all the drivers that you're not going to even know until you get the camera from the red, green lights, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to subpoena the city, and then you're going to have to review it, and then you're going to have to find these people. You know how expensive that would be for a fender bender? Like, that is not proportional. So Angie would be like, hell no. I'm not doing that. So anyway, you want to keep that in mind as you are scoping out different data sources. Is it even proportional? And if it is, when would it be proportional for me to collect that data?
Yeah. Just some takeaways from this section. Number one, the Sedona primer distills current best practices, and ignoring it puts you behind the curve. Number two, early identification and quick preservation are going to be the biggest things you can do to make your IoT evidence survive. Number three, clear authentication processes protect against exclusion at trial. And number four, collaboration across legal and technical teams prevents costly gaps or duplicative effort. So let's move on and let's start talking about everything from smart thermostats to telemetrics, real-world use case scenarios for your IoT data. I'm going to kick us off with a family law example, because sometimes your smart home devices can serve as digital witnesses to things. Courts across the U.S. have admitted data from smart home devices like smart thermostats, security tracker or security cameras, and fitness trackers to confirm or dispute presence in domestic settings during divorce and custody disputes. Those devices can act as sort of silent witnesses to household events. Now, a quick technical note here. Smart thermostats and cameras can log timestamps, motion, temperature, and patterns of occupancy without any user input. And this matters because the digital breadcrumbs from those devices can prove or disprove claims about someone's presence or actions at home. This can shift credibility early, particularly in emotionally charged family proceedings. And these devices offer kind of non-suspicious, objective data that judges might weigh heavily, especially when traditional records are limited.
Okay, so another real-world scenario might be employment or commercial dispute, like fleet telemetrics and wage per hour cases. So the preview here. Imagine a dispute where an employee claims 10 hours of daily work, but the vehicle telematics show that they actually weren't in the vehicle for 10 hours a day. These systems usually record ignition timestamps, GPS routes, and idleness. The reason why this matters is that the objective telematics log, which has no motive and no reason to not be correct, unless there's like a system error, they might contradict claims about work hours or driving credibility assessments or case outcomes in favor of accurate records. They're equally relevant in showing compliance or non-compliance with safety policies. I mean, if you've got somebody out there and they did put in their 10 hours, great. But if they're like ramming cars willy-nilly while they're eating their grapes, that obviously is not a safe policy that they are following. So you got an argument on your hands there.
Amazing. So another place where this can prove really useful is in the context of admissibility and interpretation. Kind of up top, we've got this factor of, is this evidence trustworthy? Will the jury look at this and deem it? Jurors historically tend to give more weight to machine data because they see it as unbiased. You know, think about a witness's account, like an eyewitness account of a car crash versus a camera's account of a car crash. You know, somebody, like someone's Ring doorbell videos it versus somebody sees it and then recounts it. Jurors tend to, and this is a generalization, so take it with a grain of salt, but they tend to view that more objective evidence as more credible. Now, the risk here is that without context, raw IoT logs can be misinterpreted, or they can just be like too techie for your jury to really want to deal with. You know, these logs can be pages and pages and pages of nothing but numbers. And so you may, in some cases, need an expert to come in and interpret and contextualize that data for your jury so they can understand what they're looking at and its importance. Another consideration is that you might get challenged by outside counsel. There are often going to be calibration disputes. You know, was this device properly maintained? I mean, think about in a case, if you're contesting like a traffic ticket or something, you're probably going to contest whether the officer's radar was properly calibrated, that sort of thing. Source reliability is another consideration. Who controlled the device? Could they have altered the settings? And then, of course, there are the classic chain of custody questions. How do we know that this log came from that exact device? On top of all this, there's sort of a privacy and consent wrinkle that's emerging lately. And that is, you know, this issue of using personal device data in employment or other commercial disputes can raise privacy claims. Should litigants be entitled to the readout from your pacemaker or your Aura ring when that's like a protected medical device? These questions are sort of unresolved at this point, but I flagged the issue just for your consideration. Then there are also, you know, multi-user devices, devices that are shared, say, by a family, like a family car or a smart home hub. And that kind of complicates this ownership and consent for data use piece as well. All right. So to sum up this section about the real world use cases for this data, I'm going to give you three kind of takeaways. Number one, smart home devices are already functioning as witnesses in real cases. These are not hypothetical scenarios anymore. Number two, these data sources deliver objective, time-stamped, content-rich information that can sway credibility and outcome. And finally, number three, privacy, authenticity, and interpretation remain high-stakes considerations for this type of data. And so you have to handle that with care and clearly document everything. Now, to some extent, these are not like new concepts, but we are applying them in a new context.
All right, so let's move on to some more chaos. Challenges in the wild. So three things: fragmentation, authenticity, and metadata chaos. So fragmentation, I feel like we've talked about this quite a bit in this episode, but this means obviously your data is everywhere and you want to make sure that you're doing a reasonable assessment of the smart devices that are around. For example, if you have your Aura ring, then it's telling you about Angie not being where she said she was. You might want to corroborate that with, you know, another smart device that would also have information so that you can kind of prove up the authenticity there. And then let's talk about complexity. When the clock doesn't agree, and this is one that's interesting, and it's actually happened quite a bit to me because I worked for a global organization and we have different time zones. The problem is that a device is going to be storing time in different formats. For example, a device might log in 1432 UTC And the companion app converts it to local time, and the cloud platform uses yet another offset. So this misalignment can create a false narrative, making it appear that a user was active at a time when they weren't. So you need to make sure that you have a correct interpretation of this, which means you need to cross-check it against other ESI and knowing exactly how the device logs events.
All right. Now, not only is this data complex, but it can also create jurisdictional headaches, the infamous cross-border problem. Cloud-stored IoT data may be hosted in a different jurisdiction, sometimes even outside the country. And so things like the GDPR in the EU and the CCPA in California can impose restrictions on transferring personal data, which can delay or block collection. Now, this could impact you because it might mean you need additional legal processes or special agreements to access that critical data. And it also means that failing to account for these laws can trigger compliance violations or evidence suppression. Dun, dun, dun.
To sum it up, why this all matters in the first place? Well, fragmentation increases the cost, the risks, and the chances that you're missing key data that you're going to be or you should be responsible for later on down the road. You can also get incomplete or incorrect metadata that could completely flip the meaning of the IoT device. And jurisdictional restrictions can slow or block your case's ability to gather the data at all. So make sure you know what you're doing before you dive in and grab it. Without airtight chain of custody, IoT evidence can crumble under scrutiny in court.
I just love the way that your face lights up every time you say chain of custody. It's like Bree's little nugget of joy.
I'm such a dork.
We've all got them. I love proportionality. You love chain of custody. Nerds. Nice. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Let's talk about how do you design a defensible workflow for your IoT data all the way from collection to court. We're going to start at the beginning. Preservation. Get it early. Get it right. You're going to want to identify devices or accounts upfront during custodian interviews or questionnaires that accompany your legal hold and during those initial scoping calls. You do not wait until formal discovery requests come in. Let's see here. So you're going to want to ask specific device-oriented questions. For example, do you have any connected home devices at this property? Was there a wearable tracker in use at this time? Did you or any of your company vehicles use telematics? You're going to want to include device-specific instructions and litigation holds if you know those devices are going to be in play. And you want to do that so your custodians know exactly what to preserve. You want to do all of this because early identification maximizes the chances of capturing full data sets before they're overwritten. And clear specific hold language will reduce accidental spoliation by your custodians.
So next up, collection. When we talk about collecting data from IoT devices, first consider, and I'm going to say cast a wide net, but I don't mean collect everything in sight. I mean, consider a large scope of all the different types of devices that would be included in a potential collection, and then consider what is proportional to actually collect from and what is possible to actually collect from, and then prioritize what you're actually collecting and as it relates to the matter. In Angie's fender bender, we are not going to cast a wide net and collect everything. In fact, we might not even collect any IoT data at all because it might just be resolved. But you want to work with IoT savvy forensic vendors who have the tools and the certifications to extract complete data sets without altering the metadata. That matters because those people could very well be sitting in the courtroom testifying how they pulled the data off of whatever the device is. And you don't want somebody who really kind of doesn't know what they're doing to be representing you, your client, or your company. And you want to document everything. Yes, I love chain of custody, but for real, you want to make sure that you're documenting the date, the time, the person performing the collection. You need to know what tools and software were used, what methods were used, hash values that were generated, if any, screenshots or photos of the device and settings at the time of the collection. Those are just a few things that you would want to document that would be relevant potentially down the road. Why does it matter? Well, like I was talking about earlier, and when we gave the time zone example, multiple collection points ensure completeness. So I don't want to rely on just one IoT device. If that's the route I decide to go, it's good for me to have at least one other so that I can make sure that they are both telling me the same information. You also want thorough documentation that supports the authenticity and defensibility in court. So after you've collected, you've got to process it and then analyze it. So we want to make it understandable to a legal team or e-discovery team. And sometimes this can be difficult because when we have extracted or collected data from a device, it's been done in a very forensic way to protect the defensibility of it. But we all don't get all those technicalities that maybe a forensic examiner would understand. And surely the attorneys that are analyzing this case or investigation or litigation, they don't understand the technicalities of it either. That's not their area of expertise. So you want to make sure that everybody is speaking the same language and that it's easy to understand as a team what actually happened or what was actually pulled from the device. You want to preserve original metadata and raw logs for reference. Just because you collected the data, please do not light everything on fire thinking that you're done with it. You also want to tag this, not with post-it notes, please, because those fall off over time. You want to tag these things and preserve them so you can find them later. This matters because the ultimate goal here is that our legal team and our e-discovery professionals can tell the story that they need to tell in court in an understandable way. And being able to back that up and prove that they obtained all of their evidence to draw this conclusion in a defensible and reliable way.
Awesome. Okay, so you've gotten all the way to court. You've got your data, chain of custody, it's coming in. Now, how do you present it? My biggest tips for presenting as somebody who's done, like, I don't know, 25 jury trials, make it visual and make it persuasive. You're going to want to translate raw logs into visuals. I'm talking timelines, charts, and animations that map activity over time. You also want to show how the device works. It's often not enough just to say the device is reliable and leave it at that. You're going to really want to show the jury why, so they understand what they're looking at. You're going to want to use diagrams, screenshots, or even short demonstrations where possible. It would behoove you to anticipate any objections. Prepare to explain how that evidence was collected, preserved, and authenticated, especially for hearsay challenges. Now, this matters because judges and juries are far more likely to engage with clear visuals than with lines of code or CSV files. And I don't think that's limited to judges and juries. That's just like a people thing. And also, being prepared for objections increases the likelihood that your IoT advice will be admitted and trusted. This is one of the like cardinal rules of trial prep, right? Is take a look at your key pieces of evidence. What are their softest spots? What are the objections you're likely to get? And come up with a counterargument. Introducing IoT evidence at trial may require you to bring in an expert witness to bridge the gap between the highly technical and the layperson. So bringing in an IoT forensics expert who can both explain the technology that they're using and the reliability of the data that it produces could be critical to having a lay audience understand both like the credibility of the evidence that you're presenting and its persuasive value. And that because, you know, experts can address things like calibration, error rates, or device-specific quirks. They can help refocus your jury on the actual credibility of the evidence and not the red herrings that your objectors might throw, not the spikes thrown down on the road by your objectors. This can really give you an edge because an authoritative expert can neutralize those types of opposing challenges and bolster the weight of your IoT evidence so that it does the heavy lifting that you want it to do when you're making your argument.
So yada, yada, yada. Just give me the bottom line. Why are we saying all these things? What's the point? Why does it matter? Well, first of all, a disciplined and documented workflow is your best defense against admissibility challenges. Think early and proactively about how you're going to go about assessing and considering devices within the Internet of Things, how you're going to collect from it, how you're going to protect that data, etc. We also want to make sure that we are pulling from a reasonable number of sources so that we can compare them to each other and we can make sure we don't have any gaps in our data. We want to translate law into clear visuals when we're in the courtroom and when we're explaining them to legal teams, because this can make or break juror understanding as well. So we're kind of taking a complicated, maybe log or data set or even code that's been extracted from a device. And we're having to break that down like you're going to tell a fifth grader, essentially. So, I mean, that's how I think about it for a jury. Not to be rude, but everybody's just coming at it from a different perspective.
I ask people to explain things to me like I'm a fifth grader all the time.
Yeah, I probably need kindergarten, but that's fine. And experts aren't optional in these kinds of cases. They are actually essential in a lot of these because these devices are just so specific about how you would go about collecting data or extracting data from them. So make sure you have, you know, your toolkit already ready to go. You know the peeps that you're going to call when you find yourself in this situation. Make sure they're credible and that you would feel comfortable with them representing you, your client, company, whatever, in court.
All right. Well, folks, I think that's all we have for you today. Thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun. Join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, eDiscoveryChicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on our socials. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.
And thank you, Zach, for the recommendation of this topic. Anybody listening out there has a topic that you'd like to hear from us, please contact us.
Well, please do. We love the suggestions.
Yeah. All right. See you next time, Angie.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye. The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. This podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery principles and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you retained or who has agreed to represent you.